Once upon a time, three bears found a golden-haired guest who wouldn't leave their home.
This Dunkin' Cold is just right. Mm, and this Dunkin' Cold is just right.
Should we introduce ourselves?
No, Barry. The home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
Right now, Israel is facing a choice. The country was attacked by Iran on Saturday night. And though there was limited damage and just one casualty, this was a defining moment for a nation that's already fighting a war.
This was a military that demonstrated some prowess. And, you know, people hope that does give moderates a chance to say, look, we don't have to be at maximal war. We are in danger. We are in threat. But we can protect ourselves maybe more than we've thought for the last 6 months.
That is Steve Hendricks, Jerusalem bureau chief for The Post, who's been talking with Israelis in the days since the attack.
And then, of course, plenty of other forces saying Saturday was just one more demonstration of how the world wants us gone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're on our own.
Now, Israel's leaders have to decide whether and how to retaliate. And what they decide could determine if a wider war breaks out in the Middle East. From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Martine Powers. It's Tuesday, April 16th. Today, I talk with Steve about the fallout from this attack and the new pressures now facing Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Steve will unpack what might happen next and how Netanyahu's next move could have huge implications for the rest of the world. So, Steve, before we dive into the latest of what's been going on, I just want to make sure that everyone understands exactly how this attack unfolded. Can you describe a little bit, like, what happened on Saturday night and what you saw being in Jerusalem at the time that this attack took place?
Well, you know, the country, Israel, has been on pins and needles for about 2 weeks because Iran has been saying they were going to launch a major attack in retaliation for Israeli actions in Damascus that killed Iranian military officials. So on Saturday, when we'd been hearing increasingly specific warnings that an attack was imminent, in the late evening, about 10 o'clock, if I'm correct, we got word that a launch had actually happened, and we quickly got confirmation from the Israeli military, and then a little bit later, the Iranians themselves said that a major barrage of attack aircraft was on the way. Around 2 a.m., I started hearing some pretty loud booms in the sky from my Jerusalem apartment. Mm. And then they got more numerous, and I went out to a terrace. I saw a couple of streaks of light that I knew were either attack aircraft or the anti-aircraft missiles that Israel deploys against them, a couple of flashes in the distance, and then the air raid sirens all across Jerusalem went off, which was the signal for everyone to get into a safe room, a shelter, or at least the safest part of their, you know, their homes away from windows.
And how long was it until you and other people in their safe rooms realized that, like, none of these missiles were hitting their targets or hitting the ground?
It was a very tense 8 to 12 minutes, I would say. I kind of lost track a little bit because I was both working, listening, watching, and trying to make sure that I was in a safe place at that time. There was no real reassurance right away, but I have to say that around here, people are become a little bit expert at discerning what various booms are. And it seemed kind of apparent to me that what we were hearing was the interception of aircraft and not the explosions of munitions hitting a target. Mm-hmm. And then they stopped. I could hear more in the very far distance, and then it was quiet again. And that was the end of a remarkable and historic attack on Israel by Iran.
We heard from Israeli officials that 99% of the weapons in this attack were intercepted, which I think seems to a lot of people pretty remarkable. Can you talk about the air defense system in place in Israel that basically made it so that this attack ended up pretty ineffective?
Well, a lot of people have heard of Israel's Iron Dome defense system. It's come into play many, many times over the years and quite often during the current war against Hamas in Gaza. There's actually three tiers to Israel's national air defense. There's Iron Dome, which is sort of the shortest range rockets that we, you know, see coming out of Gaza, for example, sometimes across the border from Hezbollah in Lebanon. But there's actually two other tiers, one for more medium range weapons, UAVs and drones, which were in the Iranian attack, and then the most sophisticated top tier, which takes down the biggest cruise missiles and ballistic missiles. And it was those last two systems that really seemed to play a key role in Saturday's attack, in addition to quite a remarkable international coalition of U.S. weaponry in the region, and also in Jordan, their own anti-air systems came into play. A few missiles did strike and some debris from mid-air takedowns landed, but just one landed in southern Israel that caused a terrible casualty, basically the only significant casualty from the attack, which is a seven-year-old girl from a Bedouin family near Beersheba.
Hmm. Steve, you mentioned that this strike from Iran was retaliatory. Can you explain a little bit what happened a couple weeks ago that left the expectation that Iran was going to be attacking back at Israel?
Well, Israel and Iran have been trading rhetoric and attacks via proxy groups for years. And of course, since October 7th, that's been more intense than usual. But 2 weeks ago, Israel presumably was behind an attack on a compound in Damascus, Syria, that Iran says was a diplomatic compound. It had diplomatic signage on it. Israel disputes that, actually, and says it was not registered as a diplomatic compound. But in any case, there was a very surgical strike on one of the buildings, and it killed at least seven members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. And that quickly prompted pledges of retaliation from Iran at all levels of leadership. And they got very specific. They began to imply that this would be an attack directly on Israel, possibly Israeli facilities overseas, diplomatic compounds, or Israeli soil itself. And that's what was such a notable escalation that really caused a lot of anxiety, not just for the attack, but for the implications that that could lead to a much broader regional war than is already sort of devastating Israel, the Palestinian territories, and Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, as you're describing this, I have to wonder, like, why did Israel target this compound in Damascus and essentially kill these Iranian military leaders? Like, it seems like there's a lot going on for Israel in this moment. Like, why choose this moment to try to, like, ratchet things up in Iran?
It's not unusual for Israel to target Iranian leaders in the countries where they have proxy forces. That has happened many times over the years. And what Israelis say, what the military and political leadership say, is they've been under attack from Iran since October 7th. So for 6 months, from their point of view, they've been in a battle with Iran. Now, obviously, Iran is not in Gaza, but Israel says Iran is responsible for the buildup and the arming of Hamas. They're responsible for Hezbollah forces that are launching missiles almost every day from Lebanon into Israel, and the Houthi rebels in Yemen that are attacking shipping in the Red Sea and also shooting missiles at or towards Israel. So from their point of view, this was not an initiative event. It was part of an ongoing campaign. Obviously, the Iranians reacted differently, described it differently, and frankly, a lot of the world saw this as an escalation. They then saw Iran's response as a retaliation and are hoping that that'll be the end of it. I don't think that's likely to be the case.
Yeah. So what happens now? Like, what are the options in front of Israel and how to respond to this most recent attack?
I think the Israeli government and security establishment is divided. There was actually quite a lot of satisfaction on Sunday morning when they realized that they had repelled this attack so completely. Mm-hmm. It was in some ways a restoration of the Israeli military's sense of abilities, which had been badly damaged, even among Israelis, on October 7th, when they failed to anticipate those attacks and so many Israeli civilians were killed. There's been a kind of a lack of confidence since then. So there was a sense both that they had demonstrated that their abilities were pretty sophisticated against a threat that is long anticipated as sort of Israel's top existential threat, which is an attack from Iran, which is a burgeoning nuclear power. So there was a lot of satisfaction about that. There was tremendous satisfaction that this international coalition, quite a remarkable one, had formed with U.S. warships and aircraft, U.K. and French, and as I said, even Jordanian military took a hand. And beyond that, there was this remarkable phenomenon of countries all around the region closing their airspace and grounding their own commercial air traffic. Now, obviously, there's some good practical reasons to ground your planes when there might be warcraft overhead.
But it seems to have let this impression that these countries were sort of coming to Israel's defense in this critical moment.
That's what it felt like, and that's how it's being interpreted. Iran is perceived by a lot of countries as a regional threat. And so what did happen was every government in the region did something that made this defensive operation work better. On the day after, there were immediate calls from various levels of the government for a massive retaliatory attack. Hmm. Iran cannot target Israeli soil and not face a massive response, is the argument for a lot of the most hawkish elements, both in the government and outside. That was a very common refrain, and we know from reporting that even within Israel's emergency war cabinet, there were voices saying, this should begin tonight.
Well, but then what's the argument against that? I think a lot of people could see the reason why retaliation in this situation feels justified when a country sends a bunch of missiles at you. But, like, what's the other way to look at it in which this would not be the right way to respond?
Probably the main reason is they're getting a lot of pressure from Washington and other allies not to make a big response, to take the win, as President mm-hmm. Biden reportedly said to Benjamin Netanyahu in a call soon after those events.
How interesting.
And to not...
Can you explain more what he means by that?
It was a tremendous achievement to have that 99% success rate in bringing down the aircraft. That the carnage that could have happened if even one of those had hit a population center is significant. And we would be having a very different conversation today. Mm-hmm. So there is an argument being made that Israel has demonstrated its military prowess. It has enjoyed the support of these allies in ways that we've never really seen before. And that can be enough, that can count as a victory. Mm-hmm. That's the win. And that's getting some attention here. We understand that there are debates in the war cabinet and voices on the outside certainly saying maybe we'll be able to deliver a very hard blow to Iran. Certainly they have the military capability to do that. But whatever that blow is may not give them as much long-term strategic advantage as carrying on with the momentum that they saw from Saturday night, this regional cooperation, the return of Israel into the fold, as it were, after so much growing international condemnation of its conduct of the war in Gaza and the horrifying civilian casualties there. For the first time in months, Israel feels like it has the support of its friends in a very public way again. Hmm. And so there might be a bigger win than a solid counterpunch to Iran just in seeing where they can take that new reality.
And what could that achieve? Like, how could that help Israel in coming weeks if they use it the right way?
Well, you hear a lot of scenarios, and some of them are very optimistic and some of them are very pessimistic. I guess the average of them is it just gives Benjamin Netanyahu a little more operating room than he's had. He has a very narrow governing majority. He is very unpopular in Israel following the events of October 7th and the failure so far to bring the rest of the Israeli hostages home from captivity in Gaza. And it wouldn't take much for his most extreme far-right governing partners to step aside and collapse his government. And he has behaved in a way in recent months that are kind of unlike his historic posture. He's known as a very cautious politician, prone to delaying decisions and big actions and taking the minimal route when possible. Mm. He's talking in a much more maximalist way about actions in Gaza, about the need to go into the final stronghold of Rafah, where more than a million civilians are taking shelter, in part at least because his right wing demands that. There is some thought that now that he has achieved or overseen this significant military operation, that he's got a little bit of leverage not to do what they demand. And that could translate into a different course of action in Gaza, a delay in the promised invasion of Rafah, an increase, finally, in the amount of humanitarian aid going in, which is not looked on favorably by these most extreme right-wing members of the government. So that could be the payoff in the short term. In the long term, in this optimistic view, it could begin to reorient things, you know, based on the situation in Gaza as it progresses, towards a longer-term solution along the lines that President Biden has been advocating, where there is a Palestinian presence in the governance of Gaza after the war, where there is the beginning of talks about a longer-term solution that may provide the Palestinians with more independence and change the hostilities between the two sides, that Saudi Arabia may resume its pursuit or its negotiations towards normalized relations with Israel, which is extremely important to Netanyahu and to Israelis, as it represents a real change in the regional dynamic in its relationship with its Arab neighbors. Mm-hmm. That's all very optimistic at a very pessimistic time, but those are the arguments that are being made.
After the break, Steve explains the flip side to that argument. We'll be right back.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
I find this all incredibly interesting to hear and also feel, as you said, like that this is a pretty optimistic view of what could be happening, that this is the off-ramp, essentially, and that this moment is a path toward peace. I think looking at how the last 6 months have unfolded, a lot of people have reason to be skeptical of that, skeptical of Benjamin Netanyahu taking the off-ramp or using this moment to de-escalate. And there are some really valid concerns that this is a moment that is going to escalate into an even wider war than what we have right now. Can you talk about those concerns or essentially the flip side of like what the worst case scenario is here, like how this most recent attack, even though the casualties in Israel were almost next to nothing, that it could be the step that gets us into an even bigger and more unwieldy war?
Yeah, well, there's numerous paths to a bigger war for sure. And that is a tremendous and a very current fear. Look, Israel has been worried about and warning the world that it is in Iran's crosshairs for years, and it has been described as, you know, their number one existential fear, certainly in Netanyahu's recent terms. This is what they've been dreading, a major military attack from Iran to Israel. So for many people here, that's enough. That's an action that requires the biggest possible response up to a major attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. Obviously, that would suddenly amount to something like a regional war with massive attacks going back and forth. Easy to imagine that the Hezbollah in Lebanon, which has been attacking Israel with missiles, but has actually been relatively restrained, not the full-on assault that Hamas had hoped for and asked for as October 7th was happening. That finally the moment might be where they did engage fully and the Houthis picked up their activities and Iranian proxies got more active in countries around the region.
What would that mean for Israel, like essentially fighting two wars at the same time?
They say they don't want to do it, but they say they have the capability to if they have to. And they have pulled largely out of Gaza. There's nothing like the presence of Israeli troops inside of Gaza at this moment. And they said that was for rest and in preparation for future action in the south around Rafah. But it does make them available for any activities in the north. And of course, the major war with Iran we're talking about wouldn't at first be a ground war with combat troops. You know, it would be very much an air war, presumably. And the weapons that would be employed there are not really the ones that they are using in Gaza, where you're talking about attack helicopters and tanks. And in this, we're talking about fighter jets and these sophisticated anti-aircraft missile defense systems.
To what extent does the U.S. have the ability to influence where Netanyahu and other Israeli officials ultimately decide to go? Because, you know, this is a moment where obviously the U.S. is having a lot of conversations about how much we are willing to support Israel, especially since the killing of the folks who worked for the World Central Kitchen. You know, I think that there's been so much backlash here and real questions around, you know, how much should we be continuing to provide military aid to Israel essentially without any conditions? The fact that the U.S. has been saying over the last couple of days, like, look, we do not want this to escalate further. We don't support any counterattack. Like, is Netanyahu hearing that? Does Israel care that much whether the U.S. wants them to take plan A or plan B?
He certainly hears it. You know, we hear that from administration officials. We hear it in public from the White House. I mean, the frustrations include the attack on Damascus a couple of weeks ago. The White House was very clear they didn't support that. And we have reporting from the administration they didn't even get an advance warning. So, and yet, as many people have noted, even though Netanyahu is not bent to Biden's will, as it were, the shipments of arms and the approval of future shipments continues. And I think Saturday's attack plays into that to a certain degree because it demonstrates to the world that Israel, you know, as it says, is a target of this major military power in the region, and it does need weapons. So there's another argument in addition to what's happening in Gaza for them. But there's clearly frustration, and I think what's going to be the most interesting thing over the next couple of days is whether anything changes in that regard. The Israeli officials and military officials tell us they are listening. They are opening new avenues of aid into Gaza. They've said they're in the process of repairing the damaged Erez crossing and opening port facilities in the area that can also be used. But we're not seeing confirmation of that yet. As has happened many times in this conflict, we're just unable to demonstrate that a lot more aid is going in, that it's being securely distributed. So it's very opaque, and it's very difficult to say whether anything will change in this regard. But it is clear that this event on Saturday night at least shook up the sort of stalemate that had been in place for a few weeks. And whether or not it changes things on the ground, I think we're just going to have to see and listen to what the next several days brings. There's a major Jewish holiday in Israel on Passover next week. You know, I'm told that we probably won't see anything definitive announced in terms of its plans for Iran before then, but clearly the pressures are shifting almost by the day.
Steve, thank you so much for explaining all this. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Martine.
Steve Hendricks is the Jerusalem bureau chief for The Post. Before we go, here's one other story that I have my eye on today. There's new movement on Capitol Hill to oust GOP House Speaker Mike Johnson. The threat comes as he unveiled four bills this week to address funding for U.S. allies. Johnson's strategy is to separate aid to Israel from aid to Ukraine, which has been a controversial topic within his party. It's already getting blowback from some of his members. Two far-right Republicans are calling on him to resign. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene called Johnson's plan a, quote, scam. She threatened to introduce a measure to remove the speaker if he puts Ukraine aid on the floor. That puts his speakership and support for the legislation on shaky ground. House Republicans have a very slim two-seat majority right now. And next week, after the departure of another GOP congressman, they will only have a one-seat majority. Johnson has called Greene's threat, quote, absurd. And he has said that he will not resign. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Reini Shrinovsky. It was mixed by Sam Baer and edited by Lucy Perkins. Thank you also to Jesse Messner-Hage and Maggie Penman. Being a subscriber to The Washington Post now comes with a new audio benefit. You can listen to Washington Post audio articles in our new podcast feed in Apple Podcasts. It's called Don't Miss Articles. Each episode is a different Post article, handpicked to bring you a great mix on the go. You'll need to be a subscriber to listen, so connect your Washington Post subscription in Apple Podcasts or subscribe at washingtonpost.com/subscribe. I'm Martine Powers. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.